This topic has been a hot topic for about 2,000 years, but it seems to be enjoying a particular vigorous life at the moment, basically because of our two protagonists today, most conspicuously Richard Dawkins. But let me... Richard is not simply the author of this book. He is a very distinguished writer and geneticist, biologist?
Evolutionist.
Evolutionist, thank you. He's very clever. He came to fame really with The Selfish Gene, which I'm sure we've all got on our shelves and which is still obviously selling like hotcakes. More books followed: The Blind Watchmaker, River Out of Eden, Climbing Mount Improbable, Unweaving the Rainbow, The Ancestor's Tale, and a collection of articles called The Devil's Chaplain. With titles like that, it won't surprise you that he's a fellow both of the Royal Society and of the Royal Society for Literature. So he is very much has a foot in each camp, literature and science, I mean. Most recently, though, The God Delusion has rather moved his style and his remit. It's a powerful polemic that targets all of religions and all the degrees and kinds of religious belief. Its tone is one of forthright aggression towards extremist religions, which has delighted his fans and led others to dismiss him as a fundamentalist atheist. Now, also published is this book, a slighter and more quickly written piece, which is an answer to Richard, and it's written by Alistair McGrath, who's here with me, who is Professor of Historical Theology at Oxford. Now, formerly Alistair was an atheist himself. He has a doctorate in molecular biophysics, but now he's become a leading Christian theologian. His recent books, among his recent books, is Dawkins' God. Are you pleased with that?
There is a book called Darwin's God, which I strongly recommend. But
Dawkins' God, Genes, Memes, and the Meaning of Life, and now this one, The Dawkins Delusion. Now, this is how it's going to proceed, because there's a lot to be said, and you might want to join in too. I'm going to ask Richard to address his book for about 10 minutes, and then I'm going to ask Alistair to address his. But then I hope that they will exchange, because I'm sure they'll want to pick holes in each other's arguments, by which time the hour is rolling forward, and then I hope there'll be time for you to engage with each or both of them as you wish. So that's how I hope it will move forward, and it gives me great pleasure, therefore, to invite Richard Dawkins to open the proceedings.
Not sure about polemic. I think I'd prefer to say something like robustly humorous broadside and always good-natured. I suppose the best thing to do is simply to go very quickly through the book and perhaps mention some of the criticisms if there's time as well. I've got 10 minutes, haven't I?
Yeah. I'll nudge you.
Yes. I believe, unlike some of my scientific colleagues, that the question of the existence of God or gods, supernatural beings, is a scientific question, whereas other scientists will say it's nothing to do with science. Science and religion occupy two quite separate magisteria and don't overlap. I think they do overlap. I think they both attempt to answer the same kinds of questions, at least somewhat. The difference is that religion gets the answers wrong. Now, to illustrate what I mean by saying that they're both scientific questions, the universe with a God would be a very different kind of universe from a universe without a God. If there is a creative intelligence at the root of the universe who started everything off, who designed the laws of physics, who anticipated the consequences, namely life and perhaps us, then that is a totally different kind of universe from one which just happened and in which all the complexity, the beauty, and the elegance that we see around us evolved by slow, gradual, incremental degrees. Now, most respectable theologians nowadays agree that life, at least, did evolve by slow, gradual, incremental degrees, but they prefer to smuggle the Creator in as well, somewhat superfluously, one might have thought, if natural selection and evolution is God's way of designing life, why would he choose the one way which makes it look as though he doesn't exist, which makes him his own role completely superfluous? In physics, in cosmology, there are those who accept the evolutionary view of life, but who would wish to invoke a creator for the origin of the universe. And once again, I say, the universe with a God would be a completely different kind of universe. So I do think it is a scientific question. And of course, if you believe in miracles, then that is a direct infringement of the alleged separation of science and religion, because a miracle, by any standards, is a scientific violation. In the God delusion, one of the things I did is to talk about all the various historical demonstrations or arguments for the existence of God, and I hope I disposed of them one by one. I have been criticized for not paying sufficient attention to learned works of theology, and it's true that I have ignored those works of theology that, which is most of them, that simply assume that God exists and concentrate instead on those that try to make the case that he does. And I think I've dealt with them with good humor. I tried to erect a table of seven degrees of ranging from complete atheism to complete theism, ranging from I know that there's a God, but that's number one. Number seven is I know that there is no God. Number two and number three, four and five, six, etc., fit in between. And I categorize myself as a six. That's to say, I think that God is highly unlikely, highly improbable, but I'm not absolutely confident that there is no God. No sane person could really say with absolute certainty that there isn't anything. You can't say with absolute certainty that there's no flying spaghetti monster, and that's the sort of agnostic that I am. I'm agnostic about your God or Zeus or Thor or Wotan or Apollo, Yahweh, Jesus, etc., and Allah, in exactly the same way as I'm agnostic about the flying spaghetti monster and the invisible pink unicorn. So that's a number six. Number four, in the middle of that table of seven, is complete 50-50. You absolutely toss a coin and you have no bias one way or the other. I want to draw your attention to a very widespread misconception, which is that agnosticism, which, as many people have pointed out, is a highly rational position. I've just said that I'm an agnostic of a sort, that agnosticism necessarily means 50-50. Well, it doesn't, of course. You can be agnostic, put it this way, if you're agnostic about the invisible pink unicorn, that means that it could be there, it might not be there, but that emphatically does not mean that the odds are 50-50 in your view that there is an invisible pink unicorn. So don't confuse agnosticism with exactly 50-50 odds. I won't have time to deal with it now, but the next chapter is called The Ultimate Sevenfold... It isn't actually, it's called Why There Almost Certainly Isn't a God. But The Ultimate 747 is an argument that I might come up with later if I'm asked. So the first half of the book establishes, to my satisfaction, that there is no God, or it's highly unlikely that there is a God, it's highly improbable. And the rest of the book takes off from there and asks things like, well, why are people so religious? Why is religion so ubiquitous? Do we need religion in order to be good? And I answer, of course, no. There's a chapter on children and what I regard as the abuse of children, which is the assumption, without the child's consent, that the child inherits the religion of its parents. And I've described that as a form of child abuse. I have been criticized for attempting to be dictatorial and to, as it were, steal your children away and prevent you from bringing them up Christian or whatever it is. That's not my view at all. What I'm about is not stealing children, but raising consciousness. Raising consciousness in the same way as the feminists raised our consciousness to sexed language. There is no law, nor should there be, against talking about one man, one vote. But when you hear the phrase one man, one vote, many of us will sort of wince a little bit. We're a little bit uneasy about that phrase. It ought to be one person, one vote. Similarly, if you hear the phrase Christian child or Muslim child, you ought to flinch, because there is no such thing as a Christian child. There is only a child of Christian parents. It's presumptuous and, I think, abusive to label a child with the religion of its parents. So there's a chapter which is partly about that. And finally, the idea of religion as consolation. A lot of people will say something like, well, I just need to believe in God. Life would be intolerable if there were no God. How can you possibly bear to live if there's no God or if there's no life after death? That, of course, is completely illogical. All sorts of things are unpleasant. Just because you want to believe something, it doesn't make it true. On the other hand, one can lead, and I think many people do lead, a highly fulfilled and satisfying life as an atheist, and I've tried to, not only in this book, but in other books, such as Unweaving the Rainbow, develop that theme as well. Among the criticisms that I've had to face, I've already mentioned the one about how am I doing for time?
You're okay, Mother, okay. 3 minutes.
Okay. I've already mentioned the one about having studied books of theology. I'm hoping that the thing that's just been passed to me... My God. Okay. Yes. Okay. I didn't know that I was going to be called upon to speak for 10 minutes. I thought we were going to go straight into an argument, and so I didn't prepare anything. And so a kind gentleman offered to go and look something up on the internet for me, and he just passed it up to me. This is The Courtier's Reply... written by the magnificent P.Z. Myers, who is indeed America's leading scientific blogger. And he's writing about the criticism that people like me don't talk about theology books. I have considered the impudent accusations of Mr. Dawkins with exasperation at his lack of serious scholarship. He has apparently not read the detailed discourses of Count Rodrigo of Seville on the exquisite and exotic leathers of the emperor's boots. Nor does he give a moment's consideration to Bellini's masterwork on the luminescence of the emperor's feathered hat. We have entire schools dedicated to writing learned treatises on the beauty of the emperor's raiment, and every major newspaper runs a section dedicated to imperial fashion. Dawkins cavalierly dismisses them all. He even laughs at the highly popular and most persuasive arguments of his fellow countryman, Lord D.T. Mawkscribbler, who famously pointed out that the emperor would not wear common cotton nor uncomfortable polyester, but must wear undergarments of the finest silk. Dawkins arrogantly ignores all these deep philosophical ponderings to crudely accuse the emperor of nudity. Personally, I suspect that perhaps the emperor might not be fully clothed. How else to explain the apparent sloth of the staff at the palace laundry? But, well, everyone else does seem to go on about his clothes, and this Dawkins fellow is such a rude upstart who lacks the wit of my elegant circumlocutions that, while unable to deal with the substance of his accusations, I should at least chide him for his very bad form. Until Dawkins has trained in the shops of Paris and Milan, until he has learned to tell the difference between a ruffled flounce and a puffy pantaloon, we should all pretend he has not spoken out against the emperor's taste. His training in biology may give him the ability to recognize dangling genitalia when he sees it, but it has not taught him the proper appreciation of imaginary fabrics.
It doesn't surprise me that Richard read that out, because as he corrected me when I introduced him, I made his book sound entirely 100% solemn polemic, and it is in fact a very amusing book, and his sense of humour prevails even in the teeth of criticism. Right, now, The Dawkins Delusion is an equally absorbing book, and Alistair McGrath has taken on board the issues raised by the book itself, point by point, and is here to give us his exposition of that book. Alistair.
Well, thank you very much, and let me thank Professor Dawkins for initiating what I think is a very interesting and also very important debate, and I'm so glad that it's happening. I used to be an atheist and eventually ended up becoming a Christian. I had what Peter Kay described as a road to Damascus experience. I think really my fascination with Professor Dawkins' book really is that it raises some extremely interesting questions. And in the response, my wife, who can't be here unfortunately tonight, and I, what we try to do is engage with these and make sure the discussion really is moved forwards. And basically the book simply has four chapters. The first is basically concerned with this question, is faith irrational? In other words, is faith a leap in the dark? Is it an act of incredible irrationality? And I try to make the case that actually, although one cannot prove the existence of God, one can nevertheless give very good reasons for it. And I think that this dialectic between proving and giving reasons for is one that can be very profitably explored. A second chapter engages with a theme which I think is very significant, and that is, do the sciences eliminate the conceptual space for God? Or to put that in another way, does science actually put us in a position where we have to move towards atheism as the best way of explaining things? And again, I engage with some of the ideas Professor Dawkins puts forward, and that certainly is a significant part of the book. Thirdly, Professor Dawkins does raise some extremely interesting questions about whether the origins of faith may be explained, for example, psychologically, or indeed using the idea of a meme, the idea that he introduced in 1976. And again, I express some skepticism about these ideas, and if I had time, I'd like to look at these. But I thought in the brief time available, what I thought I would do is to try and engage with what seems to me to be the strongest argument in Professor Dawkins' book, and that is that there is in some way a link between religion, between belief in God and violence. Because I think that is a very significant issue and one that really does need to be addressed, particularly in the light of this evening being partly about trying to address the social function of religion. And I think the point I'd like to try and make is this, and that is that religious belief is ambivalent. It can be destructive. I'm going to be very, very clear about that. And Professor Dawkins cites many examples of this in his book. And certainly as somebody who grew up in Northern Ireland and seen religious tensions between Protestant and Catholic for myself, I am very, very clear that is a significant danger in any religious belief system. And indeed, one of the reasons why I myself was an atheist for some time was that it seemed to me logically inevitable that if there were no religion in Northern Ireland, there would be no conflict. Likewise, at the time I was studying the sciences, and it seemed to be obvious again that if the sciences were right, then there was no need for God at all. This could be safely disposed of with the greatest of ease. Now, obviously, I have now changed my mind on that quite significantly. And I have discovered religion as something that seems to me to be enormously powerful and transformative. This does not, I think, deal with this question of religion having the capacity to be destructive. But we need to be aware that is a possibility, and there are many others. And the key point is that religion can be an immensely powerful, transformative force for good. For example, I have a quote here from Michael Shermer's book, How We Believe, which is a very interesting book by the president of the Skeptic Society in North America. And he begins by making the very fair point that religion has done some very bad things. He mentions grand tragedies, but he goes on to say, for every one of these grand tragedies, there are 10,000 acts of personal kindness and social good that go unreported. Religion, like all social institutions of its historical depth and cultural impact, cannot be reduced to an unambiguous good or evil. And that really brings me to my point. And I think it's a point that really does need to be discussed. And that is that alongside the dangers of religion, there are unquestionably the good aspects of it. And while I see many examples of the dangers of religion in what Professor Dawkins lays out in this book, I fear I see relatively little in the way of examples of the strength that it brings. What I'm trying to say here is that religion has the capacity to do some very bad things. But also I'd want to argue the capacity to do some very good things, to be intellectually enriching, to give moral stimulus, to raise our imaginative capacities to new heights. And my real point, I think, would be simply this, that it is very, very easy to single out those actions that are unquestionably wrong and say, that damns religion, that's it, end of discussion. I want to say that wherever those actions take place, they do need to be condemned in the strongest possible terms. But that is not the end of the story. We need to go much deeper than that. We could very easily say, look, you know, there's Harold Shipman, so all medics are evil. Well, we don't say that, because we can draw a very simple discrimination between a bad doctor and a good discipline. And it seems to me very important to try and make this kind of point. There's a real issue here, I think, about recognizing that there are indeed those in every movement who would regard as extremists, who would regard as being dangerous, and who those in the mainstream are trying to marginalize in order to try and ensure that their religion is what it's meant to be. To give you one very simple example, Professor Dawkins' book was published in October, September last year. Around the same time, many of you will know, there was this awful incident in the United States where a gunman broke into an Amish schoolhouse and shot dead, I think it was 5 schoolgirls. And it was an appalling incident. I think many of you will have been deeply disturbed by it. The Amish are a very conservative Protestant sect. Indeed, Professor Dawkins refers to them in his book. They wear 17th century clothing, but they take the moral example of Jesus with the utmost seriousness. And they stated very, very categorically, there will be no reprisals of any kind. There will only be the offering of forgiveness. And the gunman's widow said that that was absolutely transformative for her. It gave her and her family the chance to regroup and begin to start living all over again. There is that side to religion. And more than that, religion possesses internal resources to begin to critique itself. For example, Jesus did violence to no one. He had violence done to him. That's one of the reasons why for Christians the crucifixion is of such enormous importance. It's all about the transfiguration of violence. And it seems to me enormously important that where Christians become mixed up in violence, there is an internal corrective mechanism. This is not the way it should be. And therefore it seems to me there's an extremely important point to be made here. Religion has indeed the capacity to go seriously wrong. It can become extremely dogmatic, extremely intolerant, extremely aggressive, as indeed can other worldviews as well. But there are those within these religions doing what they can to prevent that, to say this is the authentic way of being Christian or being Muslim, and trying to redirect their communities. It seems to me that those of us who have religious beliefs need to work very, very strongly for those. And those of you who are critics of religion in this audience also need to help us by trying to make sure that those who are extremists really are confronted in order that something can be done about this. But for me, religion, or is my personal faith, has something very simple and very powerful to say. It's saying that one may appreciate this world and see it in all its beauty, all its glory, but at the same time be aware that this beautiful world points beyond itself to something else. It is an invitation to discover, an invitation to move beyond the limits of where we are and discover something else as well, which is both enriching and, in my view, ennobling. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, there are many questions that arise, certainly in my mind, to both of those, but I want not to be a partaker so much as the chair of an exchange of views now. Richard, would you like to pick up points from what...
Yes, I would. Alistair's eloquence about the goodness of religious people, of course, I entirely agree with, and that's not in dispute. I'm not in the business of totting up good deeds and bad deeds that are done by religious people and done by non-religious people. If every good deed in the world was done by a religious person, that wouldn't move me in the slightest degree, because what I care about is what's true. I want to know, is there a God in the universe or not? And the fact that, if it is a fact, which I doubt, but if it were a fact that religion makes people good, that would, of course, not in the slightest degree make it true what they believe, which is that there is some kind of supernatural creation. So I'm quite happy to accept everything Alistair said about the good things that are done in the name of religion. A slightly more interesting approach would be, rather than ask, as a matter of fact, can we count up good people, bad people on both sides, is there any general reason to expect good deeds or bad deeds to flow from religion? And we might think about those. He also said that religion is intellectually enriching. That, I must say, I find harder to take. I should have thought it was intellectually impoverishing, in the sense that it cuts off investigation by providing easy, facile answers to deep and troubling questions, like the questions that science tackles. Now, in his book, Alistair makes a lot of the limits of science, and he quotes my hero, and I guess his, Peter Medawar, on the limits of science. And tries to make the case that if science is limited, that therefore religion should somehow take us beyond science. There are some people, such as my friend Peter Atkins, who would deny that science has limits, and would say that Peter Medawar got that wrong. I don't deny that. I suspect that science probably does have limits, or at least it's quite likely that it does. But what I would say about that, and this comes back to the point about intellectually enriching, if science has limits, if there are some questions that science can never answer, what on earth makes anyone think that religion is going to fare any better? There may be some totally unanswerable questions, but certainly I would agree with Atkins that science is making a pretty good job, and that science is immensely intellectually enriching, and that insofar as religion attempts to answer those questions, it is stultifying and impoverishing and limiting, not enriching.
Richard, can I ask you, I think you say in your book that science cannot explain why we're here.
Well, it depends what you mean by why. Science
the origin.
Well, I mean, physics may still have a problem explaining where the laws of physics come from. Once you've got the laws of physics, then I think science does a pretty good job of explaining everything else. And physicists are working on the problem of where the laws of physics come from. But I would just reiterate that even if it turns out that science cannot answer the question, where do the laws of physics come from? Well, certainly religion can't answer it either. It's a simple fallacy to say, oh, well, if there are limits to science, there must be something to fill that gap, and what else could that be but religion? That's just not logical.
Alistair.
Well, I think, as Richard has raised such interesting questions, I'll just keep going on this topic, if I may. I mean, certainly, I don't believe in this God of the gaps stuff. In other words, there are these explanatory gaps, and can we plug God in? I think that is simply a mistake, and I think Richard showed that very clearly in his book, The Blind Watchmaker. I mean, for me, one of the great things that belief in God does is it creates an explanatory framework that actually enables you to appreciate the successes of the sciences and to really value them for what they do. And actually, if I can quote a phrase from Richard Swinburne, an Oxford philosopher of religion who I admire somewhat, explicability itself requires to be explained. And Swinburne's argument is that belief in God, if you like, gives you this way of looking at things which itself accounts for and indeed exults in the success of the sciences, but at the same time offers you an understanding of God as one who lies behind that. And indeed, one of my favourite quotes from C.S. Lewis, again, we're in Oxford, so Lewis is a very good person to quote, is, I believe in Christianity as I believe the sun has risen, not just because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. But if I could just press Richard at one point, because he made some very interesting points, and it is to do with the limits of the sciences. And in suggesting there are limits, I mean, I'm not for one moment critiquing the sciences. I'm just saying that's kind of a calibrate where they take us. In The Devil's Chaplain, Richard, I think, makes a statement which goes something like this: science has no methods for deciding what is ethical. Now, you might want to qualify that a bit, but the point I would want to make is that one of the central questions at the heart of human existence is, what is the good life and how do we lead it? And I would suggest that sciences might indeed help us lead life, but might not actually give us that moral vision that might guide them. And so really the question I'd want to explore is, where do we get that moral vision from? I mean, for example, when I think of Iris Murdoch, you know, who had some very strong views in that matter, although an atheist herself, in The Sovereignty of Good, she has this very definite idea, unless there is a transcendent notion called good, to which in some sense we can have access, then actually we're left rather bereft as we try and explore that. And that seems to me to be a very important indicator of the need really to move beyond this and try and find some transcendent ground for moral decision making.
Can I just ask whether you are speaking up for all religions or simply for Christianity as the prevailing truth? Or would you defend Islam and, I don't know, other gods, Olympus? I mean, anybody, any structured set of beliefs in gods of any time and at any place?
I really am speaking as a Christian, and therefore I must apologise to any present who would feel it important to defend an alternative religious position. I don't know enough about them, really, to feel I can speak competently.
But do you speak of Christianity because you believe it to be the prevailing, unique truth about things?
I believe in Christianity because I believe it to be true. That's very, very clear for me.
Right, Richard.
Coming back to the point about morals, I accept that science cannot tell you what's right and what's wrong. There's no experimental evidence that something is right and something else is wrong. A scientific mode of thought, which is, I would take as a characterization of utilitarian or other kinds of moral philosophy, is a way of ironing out the inconsistencies in your moral thought, but fundamentally there are no fundamental rights and wrongs that you can derive from science. But given that right and wrong is a very difficult question anyway, once again, what on earth makes you trust religion to tell you what's right and wrong? I mean, if you do trust religion, where are you going to get it from? For goodness sake, don't get it from the Bible, at least not from the Old Testament. And certainly aspects of the New Testament have a very agreeable vibes for us today. But how do we decide which of those are agreeable and which are not? It is the case that since we are all 21st century people, we all subscribe to a pretty widespread consensus of what's right and what's wrong. Nowadays we don't believe in slavery anymore, we don't believe in child labour, we don't believe in physical violence in the home. There are all sorts of things that people used to believe in and no longer do, and that is a general consensus which we all share to greater or lesser extent whether or not we are religious. Now, if you look at the Bible, either the Old or New Testament, you can pick and choose verses of the Bible which chime in with that decent moral consensus that we all share. And you could say, oh, well, this comes from the Bible, this comes from the Bible. But, of course, you'll find plenty of other bits in the Bible which are simply horrendous by today's standards. So something other than religion is giving us this general moral consensus, and I haven't time to go into what I think it is, but whatever else it is, it's not religion. And if you try to cherry-pick your Bible or your Quran, your holy book, whatever it is, you can find good bits and you can throw out bad bits, but the criterion by which you do that cherry-picking has nothing to do with religion. It has nothing to do with science either, but it certainly hasn't anything to do with religion.
Can I pick you up about the point about it's nothing to do with religion, because you and everyone here, and indeed in the Western world, are inheritors of the Judeo-Christian tradition, which has gone into your upbringing, your background, your community, the laws of the land, and so on. And to that extent has infiltrated your consciousness, which you now present as sort of natural.
Yes, I mean, insofar as it's part of our culture, I mean, our literature, our art, our music is all heavily imbued with Judeo-Christian culture, and the same is true of our morals as well in that sense. But when you actually look at the things that we've thrown out and the things that we've kept, the things that distinguish the morality of today from the morality only 100 years ago, and 100 years ago just about everybody in this room would have been a racist. Nowadays just about none of us are. That's a very significant change that's come about. And it's come about through something else. It's a very interesting question. Where does it come about from? But it isn't religion.
Alistair?
Well, 2 points. One is Richard Wrightley makes the point that we can't just cherry-pick the Bible. We have to have some scheme for actually making sense of it. And, of course, if you're a Christian, again, I apologize, I'm speaking specifically for Christianity, then that criterion is Jesus, who is seen as the fulfillment of the Old Testament and therefore as forcing reinterpretation of it at various critical points. And Richard has rightly said there are some very unpleasant things in the Old Testament. For a Christian, those are seen in a radically different way on account of the coming of Jesus. So I think that's an important point to make. But also to do with morals, I mean, one of the most interesting aspects of intellectual history is that, for example, look at the 18th century, some of the ideas that were assumed to be the self-evident truths of reason were actually Christian values which had been inherited from the culture and actually had just been assumed to be self-evident for historical reasons. In fact, when you try to demonstrate those on the basis of pure reason, it proved to be rather more difficult than you think.
You have said that there are reasons for believing. You believe in Christianity because you know it to be true. What reasons do you have for believing that?
Well, I think there are a number of grounds I'd want to appeal to. One was the very strong sense that this world is ordered and that this ordering is both something excellent and beautiful in itself, but also something that needs to be accounted for. And again, it seemed to me that one of the very strong points of the Christian faith was this postulation of an ordered universe created by God, which we could begin to investigate and uncover. We could follow that through. Secondly, of course, there's a whole range of things to do with human experience, the experience we have of our own lives, of culture, which very often involves, for example, this very unusual sensation of a longing for transcendence. In other words, an idea you find in writers like Iris Murdoch, even John Dewey, that there's something beyond us which somehow brings legitimacy to some of our core notions, both of morality and general philosophical ideas.
So it's an inner insight that you feel is a driven force.
What I want to say is that Christianity makes perfect sense to me. That's very, very important. If you were to ask me, can I prove it, as I could prove, I hope, 2 and 2 make 4, or prove rather more difficultly that the structure of DNA is a double helix, that I could not do. But nevertheless, I could say, look, it seems to me that the best explanation, to use that very powerful phrase of Gilbert Harman, is this.
It's a hypothesis.
It's a hypothesis which resonates with everything that makes sense to me and which gives animation and direction to my life.
Would you agree that it's a hypothesis that makes sense?
When you talk about ordered, when you say that Christianity makes sense because it makes you see the order in things, of course that's what science does too. And what I would like to point out is that we can do without religion in understanding the order. That's what science is, entirely what science is about. And if I could take something like miracles, these are actually disorderly events. These are things which violate the laws of physics. They are capricious meddlings in the laws of physics, which at least some Christians believe the deity indulges in. I'd like to ask Alistair himself, do you actually believe in miracles, such as the resurrection or such as the virgin birth?
Well, I would certainly say that the resurrection is something I believe to have happened, but more than that, something I believe to be charged with significance. And I believe that we could discuss the idea of miracles in a number of ways. One would be one that I feel slightly uneasy with, the violation of the laws of physics. The other would be simply an extremely improbable event, but which is nevertheless significant because of what it seems to point to.
Richard?
Well, I mean, do you believe in the virgin birth?
Well, I do, but the issue, I think, really, is not simply how one makes sense of these things, but actually what they point to.
No, you are a scientist, you're a biologist, and you believe in the virgin birth. On, on scriptural grounds. You actually elevate scripture above science in this case.
Well, in this case, it seems to me here is something which seems to me to be an integral part of the Christian tradition, which may well be in conflict with part of our present-day scientific understanding. That's certainly an area of tension. I could mention other areas of tension as well. But the point I want to make, I think in response to something you said earlier, is that you seem to be saying there is a scientific explanation and that ends everything. I'd want to say that maybe there are levels of explanation. There may well be a scientific level of explanation which is helpful insofar as it goes, but then we need to add other things onto it which are not necessarily in themselves scientific but are nonetheless significant in themselves. And that seems to me to be an important point, because I think you're saying that a scientific explanation and a religious explanation may be incompatible. I think they are things that can exist side by side, both being present but operating at different levels.
The science of any one century is so far advanced over the science of previous centuries as to seem miraculous. If you transplanted a medieval peasant into the 21st century, then a mobile phone, a computer, a jumbo jet, even a motor car would seem like miracles. And I expect that the same would be true if we were to look 500 years hence. The science of 500 years into the future will be hugely grander, more comprehensive and incomprehensible to us, but it will still be science. It won't be a gratuitous importing of naive supernaturalism, which is simply a cop-out, an evasion of the responsibility to explain. I'm fully prepared to admit that there are all sorts of things that present-day science cannot understand, and that I hope and trust that future science will. And the explanation, when it comes, will be orders of magnitude more wonderful than anything that any theologian could ever, in this paltry way, imagine.
I'm going to invite you to join in now. There are two roving microphones. Oh, hands are going up all over the place. Two roving microphones. One can go there and one can come here. So if you'd like to speak first and then you, I won't invite our speakers to address each question one by one, because we'll get more input if we do a round number of questions before they respond.
Hi. First of all, I want to say...
Speak up?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Sorry. First of all, I find it absolutely horrifying that a man who was earlier described as a leading theologian and an Oxford professor cannot speak with some authority on religions other than Christianity. Unfortunately, that's something that's indicative of my experience, not only at this university, but at this college, I might add.
Question?
Yes, question.
I think that's rather unfair.
Richard, I have a question for you. Now, George Steiner, among many other intellectuals more venerable than the two of you, from the 20th century, has made a very good argument, I think, and others have made the argument that the Enlightenment tradition, the Enlightenment tradition out of which your work no doubt arises to some degree, was largely responsible for some of the greatest atrocities that have been committed in the 20th century. One thing that's incredibly disturbing to me is the work of this gentleman, Sam Harris, who happens to be co-marketed, I think, with your book currently, who advocates state-sanctioned torture. I was wondering if you could define your position in relation to the so-called anti-Enlightenment thinkers,
okay.
And if you could define your position in relation to Mr. Sam Harris. Thank you.
Question here. Wait a minute. Yeah. Question? Speak up.
Can you answer that one first?
Well, I'm hoping that we'll get more questions in if we can perhaps package them a little. Okay. Speak up and we'll take yours on board too.
Okay, so my response is to the issue of violence that was brought up. And I believe, for example, that you cannot blame the game of football for the violence of the hooligans that follow it. And from my point of view, is I think it's about the people and the psychology of the people. I knew somebody who had a violent father who was an alcoholic, and she became involved in every kind of cause. She was a Save the Whale, feminist, everything. And it was all about getting out her anger towards her father.
So what's your question?
So my point is the psychology of the people and people's natural belief in being part of groups, and my group is better than yours, whatever the group, whatever the group, is nothing to do with religion. It's to do with a cause, any cause, and it's not about religion at all, the violence at all. There's bullying and there's anger inside of many people.
Okay, fine. Let's take those two questions. The Enlightenment, Richard.
Well, I think probably I ought to defend my colleague Sam Harris, who has been... I mean, it is true that Sam Harris took a very, very hypothetical case and asked whether there were any circumstances under which you might at some point sanction torture. Now, I'm not agreeing with him, but it wasn't that he was advocating torture. He was saying that, I forget exactly the example he used, but I could imagine it would be something like, if the world is about to be blown up by a hydrogen bomb and the only way you can discover where it is to torture somebody, wouldn't you compromise on your horror of torture in order to get out of this person where he's hidden the ticking bomb? I mean, I forget whether that's the exact example he used, but that's the kind of thing. I mean, he is, on the whole, a very, very humane man, and I think that you've taken something out of context there. The point about the Enlightenment, you seem to be suggesting that the Enlightenment was in some way responsible for, you said, the greatest atrocities in human history, which I take to be Hitler and Stalin. I find it an odd proposition that the Enlightenment is responsible for Hitler and Stalin. I think the answer to that challenge is probably the one given by the lady there. Nothing to do with religion, because Hitler and Stalin had their own peculiar forms of religion. One was Marxism, and one was this weird sub-Wagnerian eugenicist ravings. But on the lady's point about... groups, in-group, out-group, nothing to do with religion, I presume that's sort of a reference to places like Northern Ireland, where I have been accused of characterising it too much in terms of religion, Catholics versus Protestants. And to that I would say, yes, it is a matter of in-group, out-group. The issues in Northern Ireland are largely political, they are historical, they are vendettas going back many centuries. But nevertheless, the labels by which the in-group knows who is the in-group and the out-group knows who is the out-group are religious labels. And so the only point I've made on that is that sectarian education keeps these transgenerational vendettas going for decades and centuries. And without sectarian, without religious education, if children were brought up in the same schools instead of the same Catholic schools as their fathers, grandfathers and great-grandfathers, or Protestant schools, then you wouldn't have the sort of in-group, out-group hostility and vendetta that you do have.
Okay, two more questions. There's someone here. Could we have a microphone here? Someone at the back. No, this, he's coming here. You go behind. Just on your left. Oh. Yeah, okay. First.
I'm rather surprised.
No, wait a minute, we can't hear. Right.
I'm very surprised to hear both speakers using the word God and the word religion interchangeably. Surely they've got completely different meanings.
Thank you. God and religion, entirely different meanings. And a question from over there?
Yes, I note you both trained as scientists, but one gentleman has moved into theology. Now, clearly the scientific method depends on evidence and coming up with hypotheses that can be tested. Now, you use the word hypothesis and then continue to use it in conjunction with the word belief. Going back to your days as a scientist, what evidence do you have that can be used to formulate a testable hypothesis to prove that God exists?
Alistair, can I go straight to you with that one?
Yes, well, should I just comment on the first question? I think it was a good one. I think you're absolutely right, and certainly you'll appreciate probably both of us were under a slight time pressure and perhaps hadn't time to develop this point in it to the extent it is. But certainly, for me, there is the idea of religiosity, there is the idea of belief in God, and they are actually different. And certainly, I believe in God very, very strongly, but I'm not a particularly religious person. And equally, one could easily find people who, for example, some forms of Buddhism, I would say, are actually quite deeply religious, but there isn't really a belief in God there. I think it is very important because certainly if we were to expand this discussion, one of the questions I'd love to ask Professor Dawkins is he proposing a naturalist explanation for religiosity or for belief in God? Because they are actually really rather different notions. And certainly, for example, you can quite easily show that some aspects of religiosity are actually quite deeply shaped by culture. Belief in God, I think, is a rather different entity. And therefore, I think your request for clarification is actually very, very appropriate. The gentleman back there, I think the key thing is one has to give such proof as is commensurate with the thing you are trying to engage with. And certainly in many cases we have to deal with looking at evidence which actually leads us to suppose certain things have happened, maybe have happened in the past. And we may believe these are very good explanations of what has happened, but actually we cannot repeat history and step back into it. Now, you probably know this, but Karl Popper, I think wrongly, said that in his view, evolutionary theory was not actually, strictly speaking, part of the scientific method. Now, I think he's wrong, but the reason he said that was because it involves making judgments of what happened in the historical past, which actually could not be confirmed because you could not, kind of way, step back in history and repeat it. I think he's wrong there. But I think the point he was trying to make is that you're looking at a whole range of complex observations and asking, what is the best explanation you can give of this? And that does seem to me to be a perfectly legitimate approach given the nature of the material. And certainly, I would want to argue that in my own way, I'm doing something similar. Experimentation is wonderful where you can apply it, but you can't always apply it.
Richard, science as the best explanation you can offer, or religion as the best explanation you offer? They're both pretty tangential, aren't they?
I don't see that they have much in common. But what was it that Alistair was saying just before that about evolution?
I was saying Popper.
Yes, Popper.
I think he's wrong.
Of course he's wrong. I mean, For one thing, you can, of course, repeat. It's not exactly experiment, but you can predict that if you go and dig in the fossil beds here and go down and down and down, you'll find certain things. Now, of course, it does lie in the past, but you are making predictions about a future investigation that could be done.
And the question of religiosity.
Well, I suppose, I mean, it hasn't occurred to me as being a very interesting distinction between belief in God and religiosity. I suppose religiosity includes things like a love of ritual and a love of going to church and things like that. I'm not that interested. I mean, what interests me is it as a matter of fact true that there is a supernatural being? That question seems to me to be the $64,000 question where religion and belief is concerned. Never mind about morals, never mind about comfort, never mind about consolation. Is it true?
More questions? One in the far corner over there and someone standing at the back. One here. That look. Yeah.
Hi. Alistair. You said yourself you don't know much about any religions other than Christianity.
No, I said I don't feel I can speak on their behalf because I don't belong to
you
them.
You did say you don't know much about any religions other than Christianity, and whether that's true or not is different, but that is what you said. And I was wondering, my lead question really is why you chose to convert to Christianity and not to some other religion, since there seems to be no more evidence for Christianity than for, say, Islam.
We'll hold on that question. And the question here?
In a world dominated by empirical science, should there be room for faith, is my simple question.
Right. Okay, Alistair, why did you choose Christianity apart from the fact that you were born in Northern Ireland?
Well, I think when I was going through a very anti-religious phase, which actually was for most of my early life, I think I felt I really need to understand what it is I'm rejecting. And I think paradoxically, Christianity was probably the ones I understood least. I thought I knew it quite well because it seemed to be very well described by the cultural milieu, though I think actually I may have got quite a few things wrong. But I also spent a lot of time looking at Buddhism and Islam, which I found to be two intriguing viewpoints. And I found myself puzzled by both of them and really unable to really feel that these could be taken with quite the seriousness I felt that worldviews should. To give you an example, in the case of Islam, and for me that seemed to be a very significant epistemological issue about how on earth one could be assured that the will of God was indeed being disclosed through such a complex network of mediations. And that seemed to me to be a very significant element. So these are some of the things that made me move towards Christianity. But I need to say that I came to the decision to become a Christian and have since then kept in very close contact with people of other faith, really to make sure I have understood what I am rejecting and treat it with great respect, even though I don't actually share their presuppositions.
Do you believe that for someone who is of another religion, their explanation of the world is as true for them as you believe Christianity to be for you?
Well, I think we are living in an era which actually has seen the collapse of the Enlightenment way of thinking. And that means that following the work of Alistair MacIntyre and others, there's much more sympathy towards multiple perspectives. And I would certainly want to say that I believe that, for example, the Muslims being absolutely sincere about what they believe, that within the terms of their own way of thinking, they have good reasons for believing this.
But I would want to say... Do you believe them to be wrong?
I would want to say that I believe Christianity is true, not in an arrogant way, but I hope in a way that says I want to talk about this and enter into a respectful, principled dialogue in case I'm wrong on this one.
But does that mean that from within your faith, profoundly held, you believe the Muslim view to be wrong?
I would want to say something like this. I believe very passionately that Islam is seeking something with great honesty and great integrity. But I believe also Christianity brings to fulfillment that honest quest for truth, and that actually that seems to me to be a respectful yet at the same time for me intellectually honest way of understanding the situation.
Okay. Richard, this question about the overarching nature of the scientific world leaving space for faith.
Faith is belief in the absence of evidence. If there was evidence, you wouldn't need faith. You would simply go with the evidence. Faith seems to me to be fundamentally antithetical to science. It is, of course, true that scientists have a kind of faith in the sense that they have a driving feeling that such and such might be a good hypothesis worth testing. But they never say, I believe it because I have faith. They say, my faith in this hypothesis leads me to test it, leads me to think that it's worthwhile to spend a lot of time and money in investigating this hypothesis. But faith itself is utterly antithetical to science.
One final question, just there where you're standing, then we have to go. We're over time already, but it's too interesting to close yet.
I wasn't going to ask
anything. Speak up.
I wasn't going to say anything, but when I heard the last thing about faith and evidence, as you know, I think that evidence is always couched in theory. So in other words, you don't have evidence or data without theory. And so ultimately, science depends on faith, namely faith in theory.
Richard?
Science proceeds by proposing theories and then testing them. The testing phase is the vital one, and it's that separates science from religion. I did want to say just one thing about what Alistair was saying about the Christianity and trying out these other faiths and so on. I could just about imagine somebody, some physicist, say, coming up with a a reason for believing in a deity that was deep and profound and had to do with the origin of the universe. And that's fine, and very often theologians do appeal to that. But how on earth do they then go from that to the highly specific details of one particular religion, such as Christianity or Judaism or Islam? I think that that's a dishonest transition from the fundamental belief in some sort of supernatural being, which I could just about respect, and then you suddenly buy into a whole lot of details which have nothing to do with the original reason that you have postulated. They come from your upbringing or something of that sort.
Briefly, yes.
I think the question has put a very good point. I mean, the language you use makes me think you've been reading Pierre Duhem and the whole idea of le bon sens, the idea that one makes a scientific judgment. And also, Duhem's very powerful argument that there's no such thing as a conclusive experiment, precisely because you're unaware as to whether you're actually dealing with a subsidiary hypothesis or the actual grand theory itself. And again, that would be, for me, a reason for proceeding with caution here, that there may well be limits to what we can say. We may live with a certain degree of tentativeness as to what we believe to be true, even though we are committed to finding the truth in the most rigorous way possible.
Can I, on your behalf, thank you, Alistair McGrath and Richard Dawkins, for making such an interesting evening of it for us tonight. Thank you both.